struggle of memory. It felt as though nothing, save his own will, held them together. Nothing but raw determination to survive held him together. Knowing what to expect hadn't helped in the slightest. It was different, and much worse than his previous experiences. He didn't know not to look at them. The ghosts, if that's what they were. Look wasn't the right word. Pay attention to them. Again, there wasn't a word, and he sighed in exasperation.
Sonne le mattina, sonne le mattina.
Tang, tang, don, he sang softly with her chorus. Tang, tang, don. He tapped the pen on the paper for a minute, thinking, then shook his head and bent over the paper again, trying to explain his first attempt, the occasion on which he'd come within moments, inches, some unthinkably small degree of separation, of meeting his father and destruction. I think you cannot cross your own lifeline, he wrote slowly. Both Bree and Claire, the scientific women, had assured him that two objects cannot exist in the same space, whether said objects were subatomic particles or elephants. That being true, it would explain why one couldn't exist twice in the same time period, he supposed. He assumed that it was that phenomenon that had come so close to killing him on his first attempt. He had been thinking of his father when he entered the stones, and presumably of his father as he, Roger, had known him, which was, of course, during the period of his own life. He tapped the pen on the page again, thinking, but could not bring himself just now to write about that encounter. Later. Instead, he flipped back to the rudimentary outline in the front of the book. A practical guide for time travellers. 1. Physical phenomena. A. Known locations. Ley lines. B. Genetic inheritance. C. Mortality. D. The influence and properties of gemstones. E. Blood. He'd scratched through that last one, but hesitated looking at it. Did he have an obligation to tell everything he knew, believed, or suspected? Claire thought that the notion of a blood sacrifice being required or useful was nonsense, a pagan superstition without real validity. She might be right, she was the scientist after all. But he had the uneasy memory of the night Gilles Duncan had gone through the stones. Long blonde hair flying in the rising wind of a fire, the whipping locks silhouetted for an instant against the face of a standing stone. The gagging scent of petrol mingled with roasting flesh, and the log that was not a log, lying charred in the centre of the circle. And Gilles Duncan had gone too far. It's always 200 years in the old fairy tales, Claire had told him. Literal fairy tales, stories of people stolen by the fairies, taken through the stones, of fairy hills. It was a time 200 years ago, such tales often began. Or the people were returned to their own place, but 200 years past the time they had left. 200 years. Claire, Bree, himself. Each time they had travelled, the span of time was the same. 202 years. Close enough to the 200 years of the ancient tales. But Gilles Duncan had gone too far. With great reluctance, he slowly wrote blood again and added a parenthetical fire, but nothing beneath it. Not now. Later. For reassurance, he glanced at the spot on the bookshelf where the letter lay, weighted down by a small snake carved of cherry wood. We are alive. He wanted suddenly to go and fetch the wooden box, pull out the other letters, rip them open and read. Curiosity, sure, but something more. Wanting to touch them, Claire and Jamie, press the evidence of their lives against his face, his heart, erase the space and time between them. He forced back the impulse, though. They'd decided, or rather, Bree had, and they were her parents. "I don't want to read them all at once," she'd said, turning over the contents of the box with long, gentle fingers. It's like once I've read them all, then they'll be really gone." He'd understood. As long as one letter remained unread, they were alive. In spite of his historian's curiosity, he shared her sentiment. Besides, Brianna's parents had not written those letters as journal entries, meant for the eventual eyes of a vaguely imagined posterity. They'd been written with the definite and specific intent of communication with Bree, with him, which meant they might well contain unsettling things. Both his in-laws had a talent for such revelation. Despite himself, he rose, took down the letter, and unfolded it, and read the postscript once more, just to assure himself he hadn't been imagining it. He hadn't. With the word blood ringing faintly in his ears, he sat back down. An Italian gentleman. That was Charles Stuart. Couldn't be anyone else. Christ. After staring off into space for a bit, Mandy had now started in on Jingle Bells. He shook himself, flipped over a few pages, and started in again, doggedly. 2. Morality. A. Murder and wrongful death. Naturally, we assume that the killing of someone for any reason short of self-defense, the protection of another, or the legitimate use of force in wartime is completely indefensible. He looked at that for a moment, muttered, "Pompous ass," and ripped the page out of the notebook, crumpling it. Ignoring Mandy's warbling rendition of
"Jingle bells, the man's mouse, wobbin, way the neck,"
he scooped up the notebook and stomped across the hall to Brianna's study.
"Who am I to be gassing on about morality?" he demanded.
She looked up from a sheet showing the disassembled components of a hydroelectric turbine, with a rather blank look that indicated she was aware of being spoken to, but had not detached her mind sufficiently from the subject matter as to realise who was speaking or what they were saying. Familiar with this phenomenon, he waited with mild impatience for her mind to let go of the turbine and focus on him.
"Gassing on," she said, frowning.
She blinked at him, and her gaze sharpened. "Who are you gassing on to?"
"Well..."
He lifted the scribbled notebook, feeling suddenly shy.
"The kids, sort of."
"You're supposed to gas on to your kids about morality," she said reasonably. "You're their father.
It's your job."
"Oh," he said, rather at a loss.
"But I've done a lot of things I'm telling them not to."
Blood.
Yeah, maybe it was protection of another. Maybe it wasn't.
She raised a thick, ruddy brow at him. "You never heard of benign hypocrisy? I thought they teach you stuff like that when you go to minister school. Since you mention gassing away about morality, that's a minister's job too, isn't it?" She stared at him, blue-eyed and waiting. He took a good, deep breath. Trust Bree, he thought wryly, to walk straight up to the elephant in the room and grab it by the trunk. She hadn't said a word since their return about his near ordination, or what he proposed to do now about his calling. Not a word during their year in America, Mandy's surgery, their decision to move to Scotland, the months of renovation after they'd bought Lallybroch. Not until he'd opened the door. Once opened, of course, she'd walked straight through it, knocked him over, and planted a foot on his chest.
"Yeah," he said evenly. "It is."
And stared back.
"Okay."
She smiled very gently at him.
"So, what's the problem?"
"Bree," he said, and felt his heart stick in his scarred throat.
"If I knew, I'd tell you."
She stood up then and put her hand on his arm, but before either of them could say more, the The thump of small bare feet came hop-skipping down the hall, and Jem's voice came from the door of Roger's study, saying, "Daddy!"
"Here, pal,"
he called back, but Brianna was already moving toward the door. Following, he found Jem in his blue Superman pajamas, wet hair standing up in spikes, standing by his desk, examining the letter with interest.
"What's this?"
he asked.
"What's this?"
Mandy echoed faithfully, rushing over and scrambling up on the chair to see.
"It's a letter from your grandad," Brianna replied, not missing a beat.
She put a hand casually on the letter, obscuring most of the postscript, and pointed with the other at the last paragraph. "He sent you a kiss. See there?" A huge smile lighted Jem's face.
"He said he wouldn't forget,"
he said, contented.
"Kissy, Granda!"
Mandy exclaimed, and bending forward so her mass of black curls fell over her face, planted a loud "mwah" on the letter. Caught between horror and laughter, Bree snatched it up and wiped the moisture off it. But the paper, old as it was tough. "No harm done," she said, and handed the letter casually to Roger. "Come on, what story are we reading tonight?"
"Amino, nursery tales."
"Animal," Jem said, bending down to speak distinctly into his sister's face. "Animal, nursery tales."
"Okay,"
she said amiably.
"Me first,"
and scampered madly out the door, giggling, followed by her brother in hot pursuit. Brianna took 3 seconds to seize Roger by the ears and kiss him firmly on the mouth, then released him and set off after their offspring. Feeling happier, he sat down, listening to the uproar of toothbrushing and face-washing above. Sighing, he put the notebook back in the drawer.
Plenty of time, he thought. Years before it might be needed. Years and years.
He folded up the letter with care, and standing on tiptoe, put it on the highest shelf of the bookcase, moving the little snake to guard it. He blew out the candle then, and went to join his family.
Postscriptum. I see I am to have the last word. A rare treat to a man living in a house that contains, at last count, 8 women. We propose to leave the ridge so soon as the climate thaws, and to go to Scotland, there to procure my printing press, and return with it. Travel in these times is uncertain, and I cannot predict when or if it will be possible to write again. Nor do I know whether you will receive this letter at all, but I proceed in necessary faith that you will. I wished to tell you of the disposition of the property which was once held in trust by the Camerons for an Italian gentleman. I think it unwise to carry this with us, and have therefore removed it to a place of safety. Jem knows the place. If you should at some time have need of this property, tell him the Spaniard guards it. If so, be sure to have it blessed by a priest. There is blood upon it. Sometimes I wish that I might see the future. Much more often I give thanks to God that I cannot. But I will always see your faces. Kiss the children for me. Your loving father, J.F.
The children, washed, toothbrushed, kissed, and put to bed, their parents returned to the library, a dram of whiskey, and the letter.
An Italian gentleman.
Bree looked at Roger, one brow raised in a way that brought Jamie Fraser so immediately to mind that Roger glanced involuntarily at the sheet of paper.
Does he mean Charles Stuart? It can't mean anyone else.
She picked the letter up and read the postscript for perhaps the 1000th time.
And if he does mean Charles Stuart, then the property... He's found the gold. And Jem knows where it is?
Roger couldn't help this last taking on the tone of a question as he cast his eyes toward the ceiling, above which his children were presumably asleep, wrapped in virtue and cartoon pajamas. Bree frowned.
Does he?
That isn't exactly what Da said, and if he did know, that's an awfully big secret to ask an 8-year-old boy to keep.
True.
8 or not, Jem was very good at keeping secrets, Roger thought. But Bree was right. Her father would never burden anyone with dangerous information, let alone his beloved grandson. Certainly not without a good reason, and his postscript made it clear that this information was provided only as a contingency in case of need.
You're right. Jem doesn't know anything about the gold, just about this Spaniard, whatever that may be. He's never mentioned anything like that to you.
She shook her head, then turned as a sudden puff of wind from the open window blew through the curtains, breathing imminent rain. Bree got up and went hastily to close it, then trotted upstairs to close the windows there, waving at Roger to see to those on the ground floor. Lallybroch was a large house and unusually well provided with windows. The children kept trying to count them, but never came up with the same number twice. Roger supposed he could go and count them himself one day and settle the matter, but was reluctant to do this. The house, like most old houses, had a distinct personality. Lallybroch was welcoming, all right, large and gracious, comfortably rather than grandly built, with the echoes of generations murmuring in its walls. But it was a place that had its secrets too, no doubt of that. And hiding the number of its windows was quite in keeping with the sense he had of the house as being rather playful. The windows in the kitchen, now equipped with modern refrigerator, Aga cooker, and decent plumbing, but still with its ancient granite counters stained with the juice of currants, the blood of game and poultry, were all closed, but he went through it nonetheless, and through the scullery. The light in the back hall was off, but he could see the grating in the floor near the wall that gave air to the priest's hole below. His father-in-law had hidden there briefly during the days after the rising before being imprisoned at Ardsmuir. Roger had gone down there once, also briefly, when they had bought the house, and had come up out of the dank, fetid little space with a complete understanding of why Jamie Fraser had chosen to live in a wilderness on a remote mountain top, where there was no constraint in any direction. Years of hiding, of duress, of imprisonment. Jamie Fraser was not a political creature, and he knew better than most what the true cost of war was, whatever its presumed purpose. But Roger had seen his father-in-law now and then rub absently at his wrists, where the marks of fetters had long since faded, but the memory of their weight had not. Roger had not the slightest doubt that Jamie Fraser would live free or die, and wished, for an instant, with a longing that gnawed his bones, that he might be there to fight by his father-in-law's side. The rain had started. He could hear the patter of it on the slate roofs of the outbuildings, then the rush as it came on in earnest, wrapping the house in mist and water.
"For ourselves and our posterity," he said aloud but quietly.
It was a bargain made between men, unspoken but understood completely. Nothing mattered but that the family be preserved, the children protected. And whether the cost of it was paid in blood, sweat, or soul, it would be paid.
"Oichava," he said,
with a brief nod in the direction of the priest's hole.
"Good night, then."
He stood a moment longer in the old kitchen, though, feeling the embrace of the house, its solid protection against the storm. The kitchen had always been the heart of the house, he thought, and found the warmth of the cooker as much a comfort as the fire on the now empty hearth had once been. He met Brianna at the foot of the stairs. She'd changed for bed, as opposed to sleep. The air in the house was always cool, and the temperature had dropped several degrees with the onset of rain. She wasn't wearing her woolies, though, rather a thin nightgown of white cotton, deceptively innocent-looking, with a small red ribbon threaded through it. The white cloth clung to the shape of her breasts like cloud to a mountain peak. He said as much, and she laughed, but made no objection when he cupped his hands around them, her nipples against his palms, round as beach pebbles, through the thin cloth. "Upstairs," she whispered, and leaning in, ran the tip of her tongue along his lower lip. "No," he said, and kissed her solidly, quelling the tickle of the touch. "In the kitchen. We haven't done it there yet." He had her, bent over the ancient counter with its mysterious stains, the sound of her small grunts a punctuation to the rush of wind and rain on the ancient shutters, felt her shiver and liquefy, and let go, too, his knees trembling with it, so he fell slowly forward, clutched her by the shoulders, his face pressed into the shampoo-fragrant waves of her hair, the old granite smooth and cool beneath his cheek. His heart was beating slow and hard, steady as a bass drum. He was naked, and a cold draught from somewhere raised goose flesh down his back and legs. Brianna felt him shiver and turned her face to his. "Cold?" she whispered. She wasn't. She glowed like a live coal, and he wanted nothing more than to slide into bed beside her and ride out the storm in snug warmth. "I'm fine." He bent and scooped up the clothes he had thrown on the floor. "Let's go to bed." The rain was louder upstairs. "Oh, the animals went in two by two," Bree sang softly as they climbed the stairs. "The elephants and the kangaroos." Roger smiled. "You could imagine the house an ark, floating on a roaring world of water, but all snug within. Two by two. Two parents. Two kids. Maybe more someday. There was plenty of room, after all." With the lamp put out and the beating of rain on the shutters, Roger lingered on the edge of sleep, reluctant to surrender the pleasure of the moment. "We won't ask him, will we?" Bree whispered. Her voice was drowsy, her soft weight warm all down the side of his body. "Jem." "Oh, no. Of course not. No need." He felt the prick of curiosity. Who was the Spaniard? And the notion of buried treasure was always a lure. But they didn't need it. They had enough money for the present. Always assuming the gold was still wherever Jamie had put it, which was a long shot in itself. Nor had he forgotten the last injunction of Jamie's postscript. "Have it blessed by a priest. There is blood upon it." The words melted as he thought them, and what he saw on the inside of his eyelids was not gold ingots, but the old granite counter in the kitchen, dark stains sunk so far into the stone as to have become part of it, ineradicable by the most vigorous scrubbing, let alone an invocation. But it didn't matter. The Spaniard, whoever he was, could keep his gold. The family was safe. Part 2. Blood, Sweat, and Pickles. Chapter 6. Long Island. On July the 4th, 1776, the Declaration of Independence was signed in Philadelphia. On July the 24th, Lieutenant General Sir William Howe arrived on Staten Island, where he set up field headquarters at the Rose and Crown Tavern in New Dorp. On August the 13th, Lieutenant General George Washington arrived in New York to reinforce the fortifications of the city, which the Americans held. On August the 21st, William Ransom, Lieutenant Lord Ellesmere, arrived at the Rose and Crown in New Dorp, reporting, somewhat late, for duty, as the newest and most junior member of General Howe's staff. On August 22nd, Lieutenant Edward Markham, Marquis of Clerwell, peered searchingly into William's face, offering him an unappetizingly close view of a juicy pimple just ready to burst on the former's forehead. "You all right, Ellesmere?" "Fine," William managed the word between clenched teeth. "Only,
You look rather green.
Clerwell, looking concerned, reached into his pocket.
Want a suck of my pickle?
William just about made it to the rail in time. There was a certain amount of jocularity going on behind him regarding Clerwell's pickle, who might suck it, and how much its owner would be obliged to pay for said service. This, interspersed with Clerwell's protestations that his aged grandmother swore by a sour pickle for the prevention of seasickness, and plainly it worked, for look at him, solid as a rock. William blinked watering eyes and fixed his vision on the approaching shore. The water wasn't particularly rough, though the weather was brewing, no doubt about it. It didn't matter, though. Even the gentlest of up-and-down motions on water, the briefest of journeys, and his stomach promptly tried to turn itself inside out, every damned time. It was still trying, but as there was nothing left in it, he could pretend it wasn't. He wiped his mouth, feeling clammy despite the heat of the day, and straightened his shoulders. They would drop anchor any minute, time he was going below and badgering the companies under his command into some kind of order before they went into the boats. He risked a brief glance over the rail and saw the river and the Phoenix just astern. The Phoenix was Admiral Howe's flagship, and his brother, the General, was aboard. Would they have to wait, bobbing like corks on the increasingly choppy waves until General Howe and Captain Pickering, his aide-de-camp, got ashore? God, he hoped not. In the event, the men were allowed to disembark at once.
With all possible speed, gentlemen, Sergeant Cutter informed them at the top of his voice. We're going to catch the rebel Orsons on the op, so we are. And woe betide any man what I see lollygagging.
You there.
He strode off, forceful as a plug of black tobacco, to apply the spurs to a delinquent second lieutenant, leaving William feeling somewhat better. Surely nothing truly terrible could happen in a world containing Sergeant Cutter. He followed his men down the ladder and into the boats, forgetting his stomach entirely in the rush of excitement. His first real battle was waiting to be fought, somewhere on the plains of Long Island. 88 frigates. That's what he'd heard Admiral Howe had brought, and he didn't doubt it. A forest of sails filled Gravesend Bay, and the water was choked with small boats ferrying troops ashore. William was half-choked himself with anticipation. He could feel it gathering among the men as the corporals collected their companies from the boats and marched off in good order, making room for the next wave of arrivals. The officers' horses were being swum ashore rather than rowed, the distance not being great. William ducked aside as one big bay surged up out of the surf nearby and shook himself in a shower of salt spray that drenched everyone within 10 feet. The stable lad, clinging to his bridle, looked like a drowned rat, but shook himself off likewise and grinned at William, his face blanched with cold but vivid with excitement. William had a horse, too, somewhere. Captain Griswold, a senior member of Howe's staff, was lending him a mount, there having been no time to organise anything else. He supposed whoever was minding the horse would find him, though he didn't see how. Organised confusion reigned. The shore here was a tidal flat, and coveys of redcoats swarmed amongst the sea-wrack like flocks of shorebirds, the bellowing of sergeants a counterpoint to the shrieking of gulls overhead. With some difficulty, as he'd been introduced to the corporals only that morning and did not have their faces firmly fixed in memory yet, William located his four companies and marched them up the shore into sand dunes thick with some sort of wiry grass. It was a hot day, sweltering in heavy uniform and full equipment, and he let the men take their ease, drink water or beer from their canteens, eat a bit of cheese and biscuit. They'd be on the move soon. Where? That was the question preying on his mind at the moment. A hasty staff meeting the night before, his first, had reiterated the basics of the invasion plan. From Gravesend Bay, half the army would march inland, turning north toward the Brooklyn Heights, where the rebel forces were thought to be entrenched. The remainder of the troops would spread outward along the eastern shore to Montauk, forming a line of defence that could move inward across Long Island, forcing the rebels back into Annette, if necessary. William wanted, with an intensity that knotted his spine, to be in the vanguard, attacking. Realistically, he knew it wasn't likely. He was completely unfamiliar with his troops, and not impressed with their looks. No sensible commander would put such companies in the front line, unless to serve as cannon fodder. That thought gave him pause for a moment, but only a moment. Howe wasn't a waster of men. He was known to be cautious, sometimes to a fault. His father had told him that. Lord John hadn't mentioned that that consideration was the major reason for his consent to William's joining Howe's staff, but William knew it anyway. He didn't care. He'd calculated that his chances of seeing significant action were still a great deal better with Howe than fiddling about in the North Carolina swamps with Sir Peter Packer. And after all, he turned slowly, side to side. The sea was a mass of British ships, the land before him crawling with soldiers. He would never admit it aloud to being impressed by the sight, but his stock was tight across his throat. He realized he was holding his breath and consciously let it go. The artillery was coming ashore, floating perilously on flat-bottomed barges manned by swearing soldiers. The limbers, the caissons, and the draft horses and oxen needed to drag them were splashing up the beach in a thrashing, sand-spattered herd, neighing and lowing in protest, having come ashore further south. It was the biggest army he had ever seen.
Sir?
Sir?
He looked down to see a short private soldier, perhaps no older than William himself, plump-cheeked and anxious.
Yes?
Your spontoon, sir. And your horse has come,
the private added, gesturing at the rangy, light bay gelding whose reins he held.
Captain Griswold's compliments, sir.
William took the spontoon, 7 feet long, its burnished steel head gleaming dully even under the clouded sky, and felt the weight of it thrill through his arm.
Thank you. And you are...
Oh, Perkins, sir.
The private hastily knuckled his brow in salute.
Third company, sir. The Ackers, they call us.
Do they? Well, we will hope to give you plenty of opportunity to justify your name.
Perkins looked blank.
Thank you, Perkins, William said, gesturing the private off.
He took the bridle of the horse, joy rising in his heart. It was the biggest army he'd ever seen, and he was part of it. He was luckier than he'd thought he might be, if not as lucky as he'd hoped. His companies were to be in the second wave, following up the vanguard of foot guarding the artillery. Not a guarantee of action, but a good chance nonetheless, if the Americans were half the fighters they were reputed to be. It was past noon before he lifted his spontoon into the air and shouted, "Forward! March!" The brewing weather had broken in a spattering rain, a welcome relief from the heat. Beyond the shore, a fringe of woods gave way to a broad and beautiful plain. Waving grasses lay before them, flecked with wild flowers, the colours rich in the dim, rainy light. Far ahead he could see flights of birds. Doves? Quail? Too far to see, rising into the air despite the rain as the marching soldiers drove them from their cover. His own companies marched close to the centre of the advancing line, snaking in orderly columns behind him, and he directed a grateful thought toward General Howe. As a junior staff officer, he should by rights have been delegated to messenger duty, scampering to and fro among the companies on the field, relaying orders from Howe's headquarters, carrying information to and from the other two generals, Sir Henry Clinton and Lord Cornwallis. Given his late arrival, though, he knew none of the other officers or the army's disposition. He was completely ignorant of who was whom, let alone where they should be at any moment. He would be useless as a messenger. General Howe, somehow finding a moment in the bustle of the oncoming invasion, had not only welcomed him with great courtesy, but had offered him the choice, accompany Captain Griswold, serving in such manner as the captain might direct, or take command of a few companies orphaned of their own lieutenant, who had fallen ill of the ague. He had jumped at the chance, and now sat proud in his saddle, his spontoon resting in its loop, leading men to war. He shifted a little, enjoying the feel of the new red wool coat on his shoulders, the orderly club of the queued pigtail on his neck, the stiff leather stock about his throat, and the small weight of his officer's gorget, that tiny silver remnant of Roman armour. He had not worn uniform for nearly 2 months, and rain damp or not, felt its resumption to be a glorious apotheosis. A company of light horse travelled near them. He heard the shout of their officer, and saw them draw ahead and turn toward a distant copse of wood. Had they seen something? No. A tremendous cloud of blackbirds exploded from the copse, in a chatter so great that many of the horses shied and spooked. The horse soldiers foraged about, weaving through the trees with sabres drawn, slashing at branches, but just for show. If anyone had been hiding there, they had gone, and the light horse rode back to rejoin the advance, catcalling each other. He relaxed back into his saddle, releasing his grip on the spontoon. No Americans in sight, but they wouldn't be. He'd seen and heard enough in his intelligencing to know that only real Continentals were likely to fight in an organized fashion. He'd seen militia drilling in village squares, shared food with men who belonged to such militias. None of them were soldiers. Seen in groups drilling, they were laughable, barely able to march in a line, let alone in step. But nearly all were skilled hunters, and he'd seen too many of them shoot wild geese and turkey on the fly to share the common contempt of most British soldiers. No, if there were Americans nearby, the first warning of it was likely to be men falling dead. He signalled to Perkins, had him convey orders to the corporals to keep the men alert, weapons loaded and primed. He saw one corporal's shoulders stiffen at the receipt of this message, which he plainly considered an insult. But the man did it, nonetheless, and William's sense of tension eased a bit. His thoughts returned to his recent journey, and he wondered when and where he might meet with Captain Richardson to turn over the results of his intelligencing. He had committed most of his observations to memory while on the road, writing down only what he must, and that coded in a small copy of the New Testament that his grandmother had given him. It was still in the pocket of his civilian coat, back on Staten Island. Now that he was safely returned to the bosom of the army, perhaps he ought to write up his observations in proper reports. He could... Something raised him in his stirrups just in time to catch the flash and crack of musket fire from the woods on the left. "Hold!" he shouted, seeing his men start to lower their weapons. "Wait!" It was too far, and there was another column of infantry, closer to the wood. These swung into firing order and loosed a volley into the woods. The first rank knelt, and the second fired over their heads. Return fire came from the wood. He saw one or two men fall, others stagger, but the line pulled together. Another two volleys, the sparks of returning fire, but more sporadic. From the corner of his eye, he saw movement and whirled in his saddle to see a gang of woodsmen in hunting shirts running from the far side of the copse. The company in front of him saw them too. A shout from their sergeant, and they fixed bayonets and ran, though it was plain to William that they'd never catch the fleeing woodsmen. This sort of random skirmishing kept up all afternoon as the army pressed on. The fallen were picked up and carried to the rear, but they were few. One of William's companies was fired upon at one point, and he felt godlike as he gave the order to attack, and they poured into the wood like a stream of angry hornets, bayonets fixed, managing to kill one rebel, whose body they dragged out onto the plain. The corporal suggested hanging it from a tree as discouragement to the other rebels,
But William firmly declined this suggestion as not honourable, and made them lay the man at the edge of the wood where he could be found by his friends. Toward evening, orders came along the line of march from General Clinton. They would not stop to make camp. A brief pause for cold rations, and then press on. There were murmurs of surprise in the ranks, but no grumbling. They'd come to fight, and the march resumed with a greater sense of urgency. It was raining sporadically, and the harassment from skirmishers faded with the sullen light. It was not cold, and despite the growing soddenness of his garments, William preferred the chill and damp to the sultry oppression of the day before. At least the rain dampened the spirits of his horse, which was a good thing. It was a nervous, skittish creature, and he had cause to doubt Captain Griswold's goodwill in lending it to him. Worn down by the long day, though, the gelding ceased shying at wind-blown branches and jerking at the reins, and plodded onward, with its ears falling sideways in tired resignation. It wasn't bad for the first several hours of the night march. After midnight, though, the strain of exertion and sleeplessness began to tell on the men. Soldiers began to stumble and slow, and a sense of the vast expanse of dark and effort between themselves and dawn settled upon them. William called Perkins up beside him. The soft-cheeked private showed up yawning and blinking, and paced beside him, a hand on William's stirrup leather as William explained what he wanted.
"Sing?" Perkins said doubtfully. "Well, I suppose I can sing, yes, sir. Nobber hymns, though."
"Not quite what I had in mind," William said.
"Go and ask Sergeant Milliken, is it? The Irishman? Anything he likes, so long as it's loud and lively."
After all, they weren't trying to hide their presence. The Americans knew exactly where they were.
"Yes, sir," Perkins said dubiously, and let go the stirrup, fading at once into the night.
William rode for some minutes, then heard Patrick Milliken's very loud Irish voice lifted in a very bawdy song. There was a ripple of laughter through the men, and by the time he reached the first chorus, a few had joined in. Two more verses, and they were all roaring lustily along, William included. They couldn't keep it up for hours while marching at speed with full equipment, of course, but by the time they had exhausted their favourite songs and grown breathless, everyone was awake and optimistic once more. Just before dawn, William smelled the sea and the rank mud scent of a marsh in the rain. The men, already wet, began to splash through a number of tiny tidal inlets and creeks. A few minutes later, the boom of cannon broke the night, and marsh birds rose into the lightning sky with shrieks of alarm. Over the course of the next 2 days, William never had any idea where he was. Names such as Jamaica Pass, Flatbush, and Gowanus Creek occurred now and then in the dispatches, and hasty messages that passed through the army, but they might as well have said Jupiter, or the backside of the moon, for all the meaning they had. He did see Continentals at last. Hordes of them swarming out of the marshes. The first few clashes were fierce, but William's companies were held to the rear, supporting. Only once were they close enough to fire in order to repulse an oncoming group of Americans. Nonetheless, he was in a constant state of excitement, trying to hear and see everything at once, intoxicated by the smell of powder smoke, even as his flesh quivered at the report of cannon. When the firing ceased at sunset, he took a little biscuit and cheese, but without tasting it, and slept only briefly from sheer exhaustion. In late afternoon of the second day, they found themselves some little way behind a large stone farmhouse that the British and some Hessian troops had taken over as an artillery emplacement. The barrels of cannon protruded from the upper windows, shining wet with the constant rain. Wet powder was a problem now. The cartridges were all right, but if the powder poured into priming pans was left more than a few minutes, it began to cake and go dead.
The order to load, then, had to be delayed until the last possible moment before firing. William found himself grinding his teeth in anxiety as to when the order should be given. On the other hand, sometimes there was no doubt at all. With hoarse shouts, a number of Americans charged out of the trees near the front of the house and made for the doors and windows. Musket fire from the troops inside got several of them, but some made it as far as the house itself, where they began to clamber into the shattered windows. William automatically reined up and rode to the right, far enough to get a look at the rear of the house. Sure enough, a larger group was already at it, a number of them climbing the wall by means of the ivy that covered the back of the house.
"That way!" he bellowed, wheeling his horse around and waving his spontoon. "Olson! Jeffreys! The back! Load and fire as soon as you're in range!"
Two of his companies ran, ripping the ends of cartridges with their teeth, but a party of green-coated Hessians was there before him, seizing Americans by the legs and pulling them from the ivy to club them on the ground. He reined round and dashed the other way to see what was happening in front, and came in sight just in time to see a British artilleryman fly out of one of the open upper windows. The man landed on the ground, one leg bent under him, and lay screaming. One of William's men, close enough, darted forward and grabbed the man's shoulders, only to be shot by someone within the house. He crumpled and fell, his hat rolling off into the bushes. They spent the rest of that day at the Stone farmhouse. Four times the Americans made forays, twice they succeeded in overcoming the inhabitants and briefly seizing the guns, but both times were overrun by fresh waves of British troops and evicted or killed. William never got closer than 200 yards or so to the house itself, but once managed to interpose one of his companies between the house and a surge of desperate Americans dressed like Indians and yelling like banshees. One of them raised a long rifle and fired directly at him, but missed. He drew his sword, intending to ride the man down, but a shot from somewhere struck the man and sent him rolling down the face of a small hillock. William urged his mount closer to see whether the man was dead or not. The man's companion had already fled around the far corner of the house, pursued by British troops. The gelding wasn't having any. Trained to the sound of musket fire, it found artillery unnerving, and the cannon, happening to speak at this particular moment, the gelding laid its ears flat back and bolted. William had his sword still in his hand, the reins loosely wrapped round his other hand. The sudden jolt unseated him, and the horse whipped to the left, jerking his right foot from the stirrup and pitching him off. He had barely presence of mind to let go of the sword as he fell, and landed on one shoulder, rolling. Simultaneously thanking God that his left foot hadn't been trapped in its stirrup, and cursing the horse, he scrambled up onto hands and knees, smeared with grass and mud, heart in his mouth. The guns in the house had stopped. The Americans must be in there again, engaged in hand-to-hand fighting with the gun crews. He spat out mud and began to make a cautious withdrawal. He thought he was in range of the upper windows. To his left, though, he caught sight of the American who had tried to shoot him, still lying in the wet grass. With a wary glance at the house, he crawled to the man who was lying on his face, unmoving. He wanted to see the man's face. For what reason, he couldn't have said. He rose on his knees and took the man by both shoulders, pulling him over. The man was clearly dead, shot through the head. Mouth and eyes sagged half open, and his body felt strange, heavy, and flopping. He wore a militia uniform of sorts. William saw the wooden buttons with PUT burned into them. That meant something, but his dazed mind made no sense of it. Gently laying the man back in the grass, he rose and went to fetch his sword. His knees felt peculiar. Halfway to the spot where his sword lay, he stopped, turned round, and came back. Kneeling down, cold-fingered and hollow-bellied, he closed the man's dead eyes against the rain. They made camp that night,
to the pleasure of the men. Camp kitchens were dug, the cook wagons brought up, and the scent of roasting meat and fresh bread filled the damp air. William had just sat down to eat when Perkins, that harbinger of doom, appeared apologetically at his side with a message. Report to General Howe's field headquarters at once. Snatching a loaf of bread and a steaming chunk of roast pork to put in it, he went, chewing. He found the three generals and all of their staff officers gathered together, deep in a discussion of the day's results. The generals sat at a small table thick with dispatches and hastily drawn maps. William found a place among the staff officers, standing respectfully back against the walls of the big tent. Sir Henry was arguing for an attack on the Brooklyn Heights come morning.
"We could dislodge them easily," Clinton said, waving a hand at the dispatches. "They've lost half their men, if not more, and weren't such a lot of them to start with."
"Not easily," said my Lord Cornwallis, pursing fat lips. "You saw them fight. Yes, we could get them out of there, but at some cost. What say you, sir?" he added, turning deferentially to Howe.
Howe's lips all but disappeared, only a white line marking their former existence.
"I can't afford another victory like the last one," he snapped, "or if I could, I don't want it."
His eyes left the table and passed over the juniors standing against the wall.
"I lost every man on my staff at that damned hill in Boston," he said, more quietly. 28 of them. Every one."
His eyes lingered on William, the youngest of the junior officers present, and he shook his head as though to himself, and turned back to Sir Henry.
"Stop the fighting," he said.
Sir Henry wasn't pleased William could see that, but he merely nodded.
"Offer them terms?"
"No,"
Howe said shortly. "They've lost nearly half their men, as you said. No one but a madman would go on fighting without cause. They... You, sir, did you have an observation to make?"
With a start, William realized that Howe was addressing this remark to him. Those round eyes were boring into his chest like birdshot.
"I..."
he began, but then caught himself and drew up straight.
"Yes, sir. It's General Putnam in command, there at the creek. He's perhaps not a madman, sir," he added carefully, "but he has the name of a stubborn man."
Howe paused, eyes narrowed.
"A stubborn man?" he repeated. "Yes, I should say he is. He was one of the commanders at Breed's Hill, wasn't he?"
objected Lord Cornwallis.
"The Americans ran fast enough away from there."
"Yes, but..." William stopped dead, paralysed by the fixed joint stares of three generals. Howe motioned him impatiently to go on.
"With respect, my lord," he said,
and was glad that his voice didn't shake.
"I hear that the Americans did not run in Boston until they had exhausted every scrap of ammunition. I think that is not the case here. And with regard to General Putnam, there was no one behind him at Breed's Hill."
"And you think that there is now?"
It wasn't a question.
"Yes, sir."
William tried not to look pointedly at the stack of dispatches on Sir William's table.
"I am sure of it, sir. I think nearly all of the Continentals are on the island, sir."
He tried not to make that sound like a question. He'd heard as much from a passing major the day before, but it might not be true.
"If Putnam's in command here..." "How do you know it's Putnam, Lieutenant?"
Clinton interrupted, giving William the fish eye.
"I am lately come from an intelligencing expedition, sir, which took me through Connecticut. I heard there from many people that militia were gathering to accompany General Putnam, who was to join with General Washington's forces near New York. And I saw a button on one of the rebel dead near the creek this afternoon, sir, with P.U.T. carved on it. That's what they call him, sir. General Putnam. Old Putt."
General Howe straightened himself before Clinton or Cornwallis could interject anything further.
"A stubborn man," he repeated. "Well, perhaps he is. Nonetheless, suspend the fighting. He is in an untenable position and must know it. Give him a chance to think it over, to consult with Washington if he likes.
Washington is perhaps a more sensible commander.
And if we might gain the surrender of the whole Continental Army without further bloodshed,
I think it worth the risk, gentlemen. But we will not offer terms.
Which meant that if the Americans saw sense, it would be an unconditional surrender. And if they didn't? William had heard stories about the fight at Breed's Hill. Granted, stories told by Americans, and therefore he took them with several grains of salt. But by account, the rebels there had taken the nails from the fencing of their fortifications, from the very heels of their shoes, and fired them at the British when their shot ran out. They had retreated only when reduced to throwing stones.
But if Putnam's expecting reinforcement from Washington, he'll only sit and wait, Clinton said, frowning. And then we'll have the whole boiling of them. Had we best not...
That's not what he meant, Howe interrupted. Was it, Ellesmere? When you said there was no one behind him at Breed's Hill?
No, sir, William said, grateful. I meant... He has something to protect. Behind him. I don't think he's waiting for the rest of the army to come to his aid. I think he's covering their retreat.
Lord Cornwallis's hooped brows shot up at that. Clinton scowled at William, who recalled too late that Clinton had been the field commander at the Pyrrhic victory of Breed's Hill, and was likely sensitive on the subject of Israel Putnam.
And why are we soliciting the advice of a boy still wet behind the... Have you ever even seen combat, sir?
He demanded of William, who flushed hotly.
I'd be fighting now, sir, he said, were I not detained here.
Lord Cornwallis laughed, and a brief smile flitted across Howe's face.
We shall make certain to have you properly blooded, Lieutenant, he said dryly, but not today. Captain Ramsay.
He motioned to one of the senior staff, a short man with very square shoulders, who stepped forward and saluted.
Take Ellesmere here and have him tell you the results of his intelligencing. Convey to me anything which strikes you as being of interest. In the meantime,
he turned back to his two generals.
Suspend hostilities until further notice.
William heard no more of the general's deliberations, being led away by Captain Ramsay. Had he spoken too much out of turn, he wondered. Granted, General Howe had asked him a direct question he had had to answer. But to put forward his paltry month's intelligencing against the combined knowledge of so many experienced senior officers. He said something of his doubts to Captain Ramsay, who seemed a quiet sort, but friendly enough.
Oh, you hadn't any choice but to speak up, Ramsay assured him. Still...
William dodged round a pile of mule droppings in order to keep up with Ramsay.
Still? He asked.
Ramsay didn't answer for a bit, but led the way through the encampment down neat aisles of canvas tents, waving now and then at men round a fire who called out to him. At last they arrived at Ramsay's own tent, and he held back the flap for William, gesturing him in.
Heard of a lady called Cassandra? Ramsay said at last. Some sort of Greek, I think. Not very popular.
The army slept soundly after its exertions, and so did William.
Your tea, sir?
He blinked, disoriented, and still wrapped in dreams of walking through the Duke of Devonshire's private zoo hand in hand with an orangutan. But it was Private Perkins's round and anxious face, rather than the orangutan's, that greeted him.
What?
He said stupidly. Perkins seemed to swim in a sort of haze, that this was not dispelled by blinking, and when he sat up to take the steaming cup, he discovered the cause of it was that the air itself was permeated with a heavy mist. All sound was muffled. While the normal noises of a camp rising were to be heard, they sounded far away, subdued. No surprise, then, when he poked his head out of his tent a few minutes later, to find the ground blanketed with a drifting fog that had crept in from the marshes.
It didn't matter much. The army was going nowhere.
A dispatch from Howe's headquarters had made the suspension of hostilities official. There was nothing to do but wait for the Americans to see sense and surrender.
The army stretched, yawned, and sought distraction.
William was engaged in a hot game of hazard with Corporals Yarnell and Jeffreys when Perkins came up again, breathless.
Colonel Spencer's compliments, sir, and you're to report to General Clinton.
Yes? What for?
William demanded. Perkins looked baffled. It hadn't occurred to him to ask the messenger what for.
Just, I suppose he wants you, he said in an effort to be helpful.
Thank you very much, Private Perkins, William said, with a sarcasm wasted on Perkins, who beamed in relief and retired without being dismissed.
Perkins! He bellowed,
and the private turned, round face startled.
Which way?
What? What, sir, I mean?
In which direction does General Clinton's headquarters lie?
William asked with elaborate patience.
Oh, the sir, he came from...
Perkins rotated slowly, like a weather vane, frowning in concentration.
That way,
he pointed.
I could see that bit of hillock behind him.
The fog was still thick near the ground, but the crests of hills and tall trees were now and then visible, and William had no difficulty in spotting the hillock to which Perkins referred. It had an odd, lumpy look to it.
Thank you, Perkins. Dismissed, he added quickly, before Perkins could make off again.
He watched the private disappear into the shifting mass of fog and bodies, then shook his head and went to hand command over to Corporal Evans. The gelding didn't like the fog. William didn't like it either. Fog gave him an uneasy feeling as though someone was breathing on the back of his neck. This was a sea fog, though, heavy, dank and cold, but not smothering. It thinned and thickened with a sense of movement to it. He could see a few feet before him and could just make out the dim shape of the hillock Perkins had indicated, though the top kept appearing and disappearing like some fantastic conjuration in a fairy tale. What might Sir Henry want with him, he wondered. And was it only him who'd been sent for? Or was this a meeting called to apprise the line officers of some change of strategy?
Maybe Putnam's men had surrendered.
They should, certainly. They had no hope of victory in the circumstances, and that must be plain to them.
But he supposed Putnam would need, perhaps, to consult with Washington. During the fighting at the old stone farmhouse, he'd seen a small group of horsemen on the crest of a distant hill, an unfamiliar flag fluttering amongst them. Someone at the time had pointed at it and said,
"That's him there, Washington. Shame we've not got a 24 in place. Teach him to gawk."
And laughed.
Sense said they'd surrender.
But he had an uneasy feeling that had nothing to do with the fog. During his month on the road, he'd had occasion to listen to a good many Americans. Most were uneasy themselves, not wanting conflict with England, particularly not wanting to be anywhere near armed strife. A very sensible conclusion. But the ones who were decided on revolt were very decided indeed. Maybe Ramsay had conveyed some of this to the generals. He hadn't seemed at all impressed by any of William's information, let alone his opinions, but perhaps... The horse stumbled, and he lurched in his saddle, accidentally jerking the reins. The horse, annoyed, whipped round its head and bit him, big teeth scraping on his boot.
Bastard!
He smacked the horse across the nose with the ends of the reins and hauled the gelding's head round forcibly until the rolling eyes and curled lip were nearly in his lap. Then, his point made, he slowly released the pressure. The horse snorted and shook his mane violently, but resumed progress without further argument. He seemed to have been riding for some time, but time as well as distance was deceiving in fog. He glanced up at the hillock that was his goal, only to discover that it had vanished again.
Well, doubtless it would come back.
Only it didn't. The fog continued to shift around him, and he heard the dripping of moisture from the leaves of the trees that seemed to come suddenly out of the mist at him, and as suddenly retreat again. But the hillock stayed stubbornly invisible. It occurred to him that he hadn't heard any sounds of men for some time now. He should have. If he were approaching Clinton's headquarters, he should not only be hearing all the normal camp sounds, he should have encountered any number of men, horses, campfires, wagons, tents. There was no noise anywhere near him save the rushing of water. He'd bloody bypassed the camp. "Damn you, Perkins," he said under his breath. He drew up for a moment and checked the priming of his pistol, sniffing at the powder in the pan. It smelled different when the damp got at it. Still all right, he thought. It smelled hot and nose-prickling, not so much of the rotten egg scent of sulphur as wet powder had. He kept the pistol in his hand, though so far he'd seen nothing threatening. The fog was too heavy to see more than a few feet in front of him, though. Someone could come out of it suddenly, and he'd have to decide on the instant whether to shoot them or not. It was quiet. Their own artillery was silent. There was no random musket fire like the day before. The enemy was in retreat, no doubt about that. But if he should stumble across a stray continental, lost in the fog like himself, ought he to shoot? The thought made his hands sweat, but he thought he must. The continental would likely have no hesitation about shooting him the instant he saw the red uniform. He was somewhat more worried about the humiliation of being shot by his own troops than about the actual prospect of death, but was not entirely oblivious to the risk of that either. The bloody fog had got thicker, if anything. He looked in vain for the sun to give some sense of direction, but the sky was invisible. He fought back the small quiver of panic that tickled his tailbone. Right. There were 34,000 British troops on this bloody island. He had to be within pistol shot of any number of them at this moment. And you only need be in pistol shot of one American, he reminded himself, grimly pushing through a growth of larches. He heard rustlings and the cracking of branches nearby. The wood was inhabited, no doubt about it. But by whom? The British troops wouldn't be moving in this fog, that was one thing. Curse Perkins! If he heard movement then, as of a body of men, he'd stop and stay hidden. And otherwise, all he could hope to do was to run across a body of troops, or to hear something unmistakably military in nature, shouted orders, perhaps. He rode on slowly for some time, and finally put the pistol away, finding the weight of it wearisome. God, how long had he been out? An hour? Two? Ought he to turn around? But he had no way of knowing what around was. He might be travelling in circles. The ground all looked the same. A grey blur of trees and rocks and grasses. Yesterday he'd spent every minute keyed to fever pitch, ready for the attack. Today, his enthusiasm for fighting had ebbed substantially. Someone stepped out in front of him, and the horse reared so abruptly that William had only the vaguest impression of the man. Enough to know he wasn't wearing a British uniform, though, and he would have snatched his pistol out were both hands not occupied in trying to control the horse. The horse, having given way to hysteria, crow-hopped in mad circles, jarring William to the spine with each landing. His surroundings spun past in a blur of grey and green, but he was half-conscious of voices whooping in what might be either derision or encouragement. After what seemed an age, but must be only half a minute or so, William succeeded in bringing the bloody creature to a standstill, panting and blowing, still flinging its head around, the whites of its eyes showing, gleaming wet. "You fucking piece of cat's meat," William said to it, hauling its head round. The horse's breath sank damp and hot through the doeskin of his breeches, and its sides heaved under him.
"Not the best-tempered horse I ever seen," a voice agreed,
and a hand came up, seizing the bridle.
"Healthy-looking, though."
William got a glimpse of a man in hunting dress, stout and swarthy, and then someone else seized him round the waist from behind and hauled him bodily off the horse. He hit the ground hard and flat on his back, knocking out his wind, but tried valiantly to get to his pistol. A knee pressed into his chest, and a large hand wrestled the pistol out of his grip. A bearded face grinned down at him.
"Not very sociable," the man said, reproving. "Thought you always meant to be civilized, you British." "You let him get up and at you, Harry. I imagine he'd civilize you all right."
This was another man, shorter and slightly built, with a soft, educated voice like a schoolmaster, who peered over the shoulder of the man kneeling on William's chest.
"You could let him breathe, though, I suppose."
The pressure on William's chest relaxed, and he got a whisper of air into his lungs.
This was promptly driven out again when the man who had held him down punched him in the stomach.
Hands promptly began to rifle his pockets, and his gorget was jerked off over his head, painfully scraping the underside of his nose. Someone reached round him and unbuckled his belt, neatly removing it with a whistle of pleasure at the equipment attached.
"Very nice," said the second man, approving.
He glanced down at William lying on the ground and gasping like a landed fish.
"I thank you, sir. We're much obliged." "All right, Alan," he called, turning toward the man holding the horse.
"Aye, I've got him," said a nasal Scottish voice. "Let's be off."
The men moved away, and for an instant William thought they had left. Then a meaty hand seized his shoulder and flipped him over. He writhed up onto his knees by sheer will, and the same hand seized his pigtail and jerked his head back, exposing his throat. He caught the gleam of a knife and the man's broad grin, but had neither breath nor time for prayers or curses. The knife slashed down, and he felt a yank at the back of his head that brought water to his eyes. The man grunted, displeased, and hacked twice more. Finally, coming away triumphant, William's pigtail held up in a ham-sized hand.
"Souvenir,"
he said to William, grinning, and whirling on his heel, made off after his friends. The horse's whinny drifted back to William through the fog, mocking. He wished urgently that he had managed to kill at least one of them, but they'd taken him as easily as a child, plucked him like a goose, and left him lying on the ground like a fucking turd. His rage was so overwhelming that he had to stop and punch a tree trunk. The pain of that left him gasping, still murderous but breathless. He clutched the injured hand between his thighs, hissing between his teeth until the pain abated. Shock was mingling with fury. He felt more disoriented than ever, his head spinning. Chest heaving, he reached behind his head with his sound hand, feeling the bristly stumpage left there, and overcome with fresh rage, kicked the tree with all his strength. He limped round in circles, swearing, then finally collapsed onto a rock and put his head down on his knees, panting. Gradually, his breath slowed and his ability to think rationally began to return. Right. He was still lost in the wilds of Long Island, only now minus horse, food, or weapons. Or hair. That made him sit up straight, fists clenched, and he fought back the fury with some difficulty. Right. He hadn't time to be angry now. If he ever laid eyes on Harry, Alan, or the little man with the educated voice, well, time enough for that when it happened. For now, the important thing was to locate some part of the army. His impulse was to desert on the spot, take ship to France, and never come back, leaving the army to presume that he'd been killed. But he couldn't do that for assorted reasons, not least his father, who'd probably prefer that he was killed than run cravenly away. No help for it. He rose resignedly to his feet, trying to feel grateful that the bandits had at least left him his coat. The fog was lifting a little here and there, but still lay damp and chilly on the ground. Not that he was troubled by that. His own blood was still boiling. He glared round at the shadowy shapes of rocks and trees. They looked just like all the other fucking rocks and trees he'd encountered in the course of this misbegotten day.
Right,
he said aloud, and stabbed a finger into the air, turning as he did so.
Eeny, meeny, miny, mo, catch a Frenchie by the toe. If he's squealing, oh, the hell with it.
Limping slightly, he set off. He had no idea where he was going, but he had to move or burst. He entertained himself for some little time in reimagining the recent encounter with satisfying visions of himself seizing the fat man named Harry and wringing his nose into bloody pulp before smashing his head on a rock, grabbing the knife away from him and gutting that supercilious little bastard, ripping his lungs out. There was a thing called the Blood Eagle that savage German tribes used to do, slitting a man's back and dragging out his lungs through the slits so they flapped like wings as he died. Gradually he became calmer, only because it was impossible to sustain such a level of fury. His foot felt better, his knuckles were skinned but not throbbing as much, and his fantasies of revenge began to seem faintly absurd to him. Was that what the fury of battle was like, he wondered? Did you want not to just shoot and stab because it was your duty to kill, but did you like it? Want it, like wanting a woman? And did you feel like a fool after doing it? He'd thought about killing in battle, not all the time, but on and off. He'd made a great effort to visualize it when he'd made up his mind to join the army. And he did realize that there might be regret attached to the act. His father had told him, baldly and with no effort at self-justification, about the circumstances under which he had killed his first man. Not in battle, but following one. The point-blank execution of a Scot, wounded and left on the field at Culloden.
Under orders, his father had said. No quarter to be given. Those were our written orders, signed by Cumberland.
His father's eyes had been fixed on his bookshelves during the telling, but at this point he'd looked at William directly.
Orders, he repeated. You follow orders, of course, you have to. But there will be times when you have no orders, or find yourself in a situation which has changed suddenly. And there will be times. There will be times, William, when your own honour dictates that you cannot follow an order. In such circumstances, you must follow your own judgment and be prepared to live with the consequences.
William had nodded, solemn. He'd just brought his commission papers for his father to look over, Lord John's signature being required as his guardian. He'd regarded the signing as a mere formality, though. He hadn't been expecting either a confession or a sermon, if that's what this was.
I shouldn't have done it, his father had said abruptly. I shouldn't have shot him.
But your orders?
They didn't affect me, not directly. I hadn't yet got my commission. I'd gone with my brother on campaign, but I wasn't a soldier yet. I wasn't under the army's authority. I could have refused.
If you had, wouldn't someone else have shot him? William asked practically. His father smiled, but without humour.
Yes, they would. But that's not the point. And it's true that it never occurred to me that I had a choice in the matter. But that is the point. You always have a choice, William. Do remember that, will you?
Without waiting for an answer, he'd leaned forward and plucked a quill from the blue and white Chinese jar on his desk and flipped open his rock crystal inkwell.
You're sure?
He said, looking seriously at William, and at the latter's nod, signed his name with a flourish. Then had looked up and smiled.
I'm proud of you, William, he'd said quietly. I always will be.
William sighed. He didn't doubt that his father would always love him.
But as for making him proud, this particular expedition didn't seem likely to cover him in glory. He'd be lucky to get back to his own troops before someone noticed how long he'd been gone and raised the alarm. God, how ignominious to get lost and robbed as his first notable act.
Still, better than having his first notable act being killed by bandits. He continued to make his way cautiously through the fog-draped woods. The footing wasn't bad, though there were boggy places where the rain had pooled in low spots. Once he heard the ragged crack of musket fire and hurried toward it,
but it had stopped before he came in sight of whoever had been firing. He trudged grimly along, wondering just how long it might take to traverse the whole of the bloody island on foot and how close he was to having done so. The ground had risen sharply. He was climbing now, sweat running freely down his face. He fancied the fog was thinning as he climbed, and sure enough, at one point, he emerged onto a small rocky promontory and had a brief glimpse of the ground below, completely covered in swirling grey fog. The sight gave him vertigo, and he was obliged to sit down on a rock for a few moments with his eyes closed before continuing. Twice he heard the sound of men and horses, but the sound was subtly wrong. The voices didn't have the rhythms of the army, and he turned away, edging cautiously in the opposite direction. He found the ground change abruptly, becoming a sort of scrub forest full of stunted trees poking from a light-coloured soil that scrunched under his boots. Then he heard water, waves lapping on a beach. The sea! Well, thank God for that, he thought, and hastened his steps toward the sound. As he made his way toward the